I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell testified today at the federal corruption trial of Philadelphia Congressman Shaka Fattah. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, Rendell defended a friend involved in the case but did not stand up for the indicted congressman.
Rendell was brought in to answer questions about Fattah's relationship with co-defendant Herbert Viderman. Prosecutors say Viderman bribed Fattah in exchange for his help trying to secure a U.S. ambassadorship. Fattah sent letters praising Viderman to Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Robert Casey and the Obama administration, but Viderman didn't get the post. Rendell insists that nothing illegal happened.
Federal prosecutors don't understand the political process. They're very cynical. They assume everyone does something for ulterior motives, that no one could do something because they're your friend.
Rendell was less confident about the rest of the charges filed against Fattah.
He's accused of essentially stealing taxpayers' money, and that's a serious offense. That's not overreaching. If what the allegations against the congressman, if they're true, he's properly prosecuted and he should go to jail, in my judgment.
Fattah allegedly took an illegal $1 million loan for his failed bid for Philadelphia mayor in 2007. Prosecutors then say he stole federal grants and charitable donations to help repay part of the loan. Fattah is also accused of using campaign cash to cover his son's college loan debt and hatching a plan to steer federal grants to a sham nonprofit to settle up with a political consultant. Fattah's lawyers have said their client had nothing to do with any of the schemes detailed in the government's indictment. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Researchers and drug companies running clinical trials are up against a big image problem. A new survey suggests only 40% of Americans have a good overall impression of the studies that lead to new medicines and therapies. From WHYY's health desk, Tanya English reports on one recruitment effort at the University of Pennsylvania.
Kathy Jajewski leads a study testing the effect of African dance on older people's mood and cognitive ability. She and hundreds of researchers across the country are looking for ways to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
And wouldn't it be great if we could do an intervention that wasn't taking a pill, that people actually enjoyed doing, and we could say, hey, look, this works.
Previous research has looked for links between exercise and a lower risk for dementia, but Jajewski says those clinical trials have limited value.
The studies that have been done are almost 100% Caucasian older adults and no African Americans.
Blacks make up more than 13% of the U.S. population, but only 5% of those who participate in medical studies. In Philadelphia, one group of study volunteers is learning African dance. The other participants are part of an education and discussion group.
It's very invigorating. It's very stimulating.
Gracie Cloyd, who's 67, says she's surprised about how much she didn't know about Africa.
It is so rich with the diamonds and how the cocoa is imported, the coffee, the cashews. And I've been eating cashews all these years, and I never knew it was cut from Africa.
Lots of Americans worry about participating in medical research. In a survey released last month, respondents mentioned concerns about side effects, safety, and feeling like a guinea pig. The survey suggests that only 35% of all Americans are likely to enroll in a clinical trial. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
Hillary Clinton made history last night, becoming the first woman to claim the mantle of presumptive Democratic nominee for president. Helping us to put the result into perspective is Debbie Walsh, director of the Rutgers Center for American Women and Politics. Debbie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get right at the history of this. The 19th Amendment became law in August of 1920. Why did it take some 96 years for this glass ceiling to be broken?
Well, that's a long story, but women's participation in politics and women's changing relationship to politics has been a story that's taken a long time. It didn't start when women gained the right to vote. We had the struggle to secure the vote that went on for many, many years, decades. And women started running for president back in 1872 with Victoria Woodhull.
What is it uniquely about the American political system that makes it seemingly so difficult? One can look to Angela Merkel, Margaret Thatcher, Golda Meir, many leading women. Why in America is the system different?
many other countries on pretty much every continent have elected women as their head of state, and yet we do lag behind. The United States, by the way, ranks 97th in the world for the percentage of women serving in our national legislature. Part of it is the system we have. It is not a parliamentary system. There are no quotas for women in our Congress, and the progress has been slow. We know that when women run, they win at about the same rate as men do, but we've seen a kind of plateauing of women running for office at the state legislative level. We haven't seen big jumps in the number of women running for Congress. And if you think about who runs for president of the United States, that pool is really U.S. senators and governors.
To what extent were Geraldine Ferraro and more recently Sarah Palin precedents that paved the way for what comes next?
Well, I think the firsts always help bring along the next people that come in their path. Geraldine Ferraro back in 1984 was brought onto the ticket in large part because Walter Mondale was facing a real uphill battle against Ronald Reagan. And in 1980, we saw for the very first time something we call the gender gap. That is the difference in the way men and women vote. And I think there was an idea at that moment that in the face of this uphill battle, one of the things that the Democrat could do is to pick a woman to bring women voters along, because women voters vote differently than men. They are more likely to support the Democratic candidate than men are. And so I think that was part of the calculation.
Tell me about changes that you've seen since you took the helm in 2001 at the Center for American Women and Politics, and then also about the education and outreach programs of your organization.
The center is actually, we're celebrating our 45th anniversary this year. I've been at the center for 35 years. And what we've seen in many ways early on was slow, steady progress. And what we've seen in the last two decades, as I said earlier, is a bit of stagnation, where the numbers of women serving in state legislatures has been pretty flat, about 23-24% for the last two decades. But we have seen progress. I mean, we are at 104 women in the United States Senate. It used to be, when I first came to the center, I could name all the women in Congress without any problem. Now I have to look at a list, and I think that's a sign of progress. We do our part by not just doing research about women in office and studying the trends for women's participation, but we try to turn that research into action. We have our new leadership program, which is a program for college women, which is now in 25 states around the country, a program to demystify the political process for college women. We want to make sure there is a new generation of women coming along to make sure that that pipeline keeps flowing.
Debbie Walsh, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Debbie Walsh is director of the Rutgers Center for American Women and Politics. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Still ahead, local artists seek out a very unlikely place to find small moments of beauty.
I can't believe that it survived, because it was just sitting there, a curl, a blonde curl.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. When completed, One Water Street on Columbus Boulevard will offer its luxury apartment house residents a splendid view of the Delaware River. But at 16 stories tall, it may be too high to read the fine print of the agreement mandating the construction of 25 affordable housing units, as well as providing for a public open space. Let's assess the river real estate with Gary Jastrab, the Philadelphia City Planning Commission's executive director. Gary, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
I was referred to an article by Inga Saffron from Philly.com calling this a bait and switch on affordable housing deal. What's the bait and switch?
Well, the development team has come back to the city seeking to exchange one bonus provision for another bonus provision for their development. The bonus provisions allow a development to have some additional height if they provide some public benefit. The development team apparently is seeking to replace the mixed income housing bonus with some other combination of bonuses that will equal the 48 feet of additional height that they received.
Seems like they have the clout. They've already built to that height.
Well, they've built to that height. That's what was approved, and the bonus that was approved at the time was for mixed-income housing. The development team is coming back to the city. They will have to file a new application and go through the zoning process again. They'll have to go through the civic design review process again. That's a process by which a committee of the City Planning Commission reviews the impact of the development on what we call the public realm, the streets and sidewalks and surroundings of the building.
Though to some it might seem like the developer PMC is gaming the system, and to what extent would some say that that's a time-honored practice in Philadelphia?
I'm not aware of any past development projects where the development team has sought to exchange bonuses after approval, especially not after the building is essentially complete. So I think this is kind of plowing new ground here, and we're taking a close look at their plans, and we'll be evaluating them accordingly.
What, in general, is the city hoping to attain with this waterfront area in terms of accessibility, amenities, aesthetics?
Well, you may remember back in 2007, 2008, there was a very extensive public process that the city engaged in to develop a master plan. Actually, at that time, it was called a vision for the Central Delaware. It involved hundreds of citizens in many public meetings to kind of define a common vision for how the Central Delaware can be transformed from, you know, its former industrial glory to something new now that a lot of shipping is located farther down the river. That vision was then translated into a master plan that was adopted by the City Planning Commission in 2012, I believe. And it, you know, it seeks to develop more residential uses, more entertainment uses. We've seen a little bit of that development occurring. The city has invested a lot of money in public infrastructure. The Ray Street Pier is one example of that. Some of the improvements at Penn's Landing, the Spruce Street Harbor, you know, is another example. So the master plan laid out a whole series of recommendations to help to initiate more development and the transformation of this district into a real urban neighborhood. We require active uses on the ground floors of buildings that are built in this area. Those active uses can be things like retail sales or other commercial services, restaurants, residences, things of that nature. So we want to encourage street life, want to encourage the development of this area as a real city neighborhood.
Gary, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Gary Jastrab, Philadelphia City Planning Commission's Executive Director. Since 2009, Pennsylvania has been bankrolling the revitalization of its third largest city, Allentown. The state created a tax incentive program to bring businesses and people to the city's struggling downtown. Keystone Crossroads reporter Mariel Segarra assesses the revitalization effort and looks at whether the city's recent political troubles have changed the agenda.
When Allentown's hockey arena opened in November 2014, Josh Tucker was over the moon.
It is the biggest happening in 30 years in downtown Allentown.
It was opening night, an Eagles concert, and Tucker stood across the street from the arena, watching thousands of people spill onto the sidewalk from new restaurants and bars. The arena was funded by state tax dollars, and it was the centerpiece of Allentown's revitalization program, which ideally works like this. In the five blocks around the arena, developers use tax dollars for construction. They then offer cheap rent to businesses, and downtown thrives. Tucker owned a wicker furniture store across the street from the arena, and he expected it to boost business.
You'll probably have Mrs. Suburbia and her children coming for a hockey game, and they'll probably see the wicker store, and maybe in the future, when she's in need for that product, she will come in.
A year and a half later, he says that's actually happened, that sales have gone up since that night, because the city's downtown has changed. He says the streets used to be deserted after 5 p.m.
But now there's people walking. You know, there's foot traffic at night. You see these concerts. You see the town bustling. It gives you a totally different impression than what used to be here, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Tucker says this is just the beginning of Allentown's big turnaround. Which is a rosy outlook, considering that the city has seen its share of trouble lately. Allentown is in the midst of a federal investigation. Prosecutors say city officials have been trading public contracts for campaign contributions, and three people have pleaded guilty. Court documents don't name the person at the center of the schemes, but they describe him, and Mayor Ed Pawlowski is the only person who matches the description. He declined to comment. You might think business owners would be nervous about putting down roots or building relationships in a city where officials are mired in scandal. Josh Tucker, not that worried about it.
People are going to do what people are going to do. You know, whatever the outcome of the investigation is, you know, things will continue to move forward in downtown Allentown.
Tucker already owns a business here, so he's tied to the city. Maybe it makes sense that he'd try to think positive. But what about the businesses that haven't moved to Allentown yet? Are they hesitating?
In fact, quite to the opposite.
Shannon Calori is in charge of economic development in the city, and she's the head of the tax incentive program.
There's a lot of people who are interested in coming into the city and are looking at the available real estate and the opportunities.
Then again, she was appointed by the mayor, so she's not exactly impartial. Albert Abdush, who's a developer in the city, thinks the investigation has scared off would-be tenants. He says a woman from New York City was planning to open a clothing store in his building, and she gave him a deposit. Then the investigation started to drag on.
And then she backed out.
Abdush can't prove that's because of the FBI probe. Says it's just a gut feeling. But he thinks there's another factor, too. A lawsuit. The owners of a building in Allentown are suing city officials, saying the tax incentive program is discriminatory. If they win, the whole program could topple. And yet, Abdush is optimistic. Because the city still has tax dollars and cheap rent to offer.
I think Allentown is the place to be right now. A lot of people investing a lot of money in downtown. And as soon as this investigations and this lawsuits finish, I think downtown will boom.
Chris Borick, who's a political science professor at Muhlenberg College, says, yeah, Allentown's tax incentives are a sweet deal for businesses. So some of them are still going to invest in the city.
They might be more than willing to deal with a little bit of the baggage that comes with the political scandal, as long as their bottom line is looking good.
There's one thing everybody seems to agree on. The sooner the investigation is over, the better. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. This weekend, a performance artist will stage a show at a recycling dump in Northeast Philadelphia. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on an art program that finds human stories from tons of trash.
Every day, 350 tons of trash come into Revolution Recovery. It sorts it into piles for recycling. So there's a wood pile, a metal pile, a pile of broken concrete, drywall, plastics. There's also a pile of domestic cleanouts. That includes family scrapbooks, old guitars, jewelry boxes.
So that is the pile of stuff destined for the landfill. That there's, it can't be recycled, it can't be reused.
Martha McDonald spent the last several months pulling objects out of this waste stream before the excavators can get them, like a wispy lock of hair from a toddler's first haircut. Someone had protected it for decades before it wound up in the trash.
I can't believe that it survived because it was just sitting there, a curl, a blonde curl, in, you know, a very, like, garden variety paper towel, and it almost blew away. And I was just like, oh, no! This is, like, an ephemeral memory just, like, drifting away.
McDonald has created Songs of Memory and Forgetting. It's a theatrical tour of small moments of beauty inside the industrial recycling business.
So the performance vacillates between these huge, large gestures and then these smaller gestures of playing the guitar quietly and reading these letters that I found. Dear Barbara, I'm very sorry that I did not write sooner. To accomplish the things that I have to do seems to get a little more difficult by the years. I'm now 84 years old.
After McDonald tells the stories of these objects, they will all go back into the waste stream to be lost forever in a landfill.
There's only so much stuff that we can keep here because this is a business and they're in the business of getting stuff out.
Songs of Memory and Forgetting will be performed this week and next after hours when the dump is not active. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.